Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
All right, good day, guys. This is Josh here with Orlando Entrepreneurs. I get the pleasure of traveling around Orlando and talking to people who are building great businesses and who are helping boost the Orlando economy by keeping their business here and by building some great stuff. So today I'm here with Britt Kane of Intrepid Networks. Britt, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Josh. Good to be here.
Yeah, man. So tell us a little bit about Intrepid Networks, and then I want to hear about you.
Right. So Intrepid Networks is a venture-backed company that's been in existence for about 6 years. Our money, interestingly enough, comes from Silicon Valley. However, in our case, our venture capitalist was allowing us to stay in Orlando for a variety of reasons. But getting past kind of the funding and those kind of areas, what we specialize in is next-generation technology for mission-critical and business-critical needs. So mainly what that entails is public safety. Most of your audience is, of course, familiar with law enforcement, firefighters, EMS. That's the sweet spot for our technology. Today, we allow first responders to basically coordinate, communicate, command, control, collaborate much more effectively in the field than they can today using their smartphone device.
Okay, so I'm a retired firefighter, and I grew up where there was radios, and we just started getting computers in our truck. So tell us about how the industry is in public safety is shifting towards technology, and how you are bringing that value to the community there.
Yeah, it's really an interesting time in that particular market space. So public safety has kind of been suffering ever since the Great Recession. Certainly after 9/11, there was a big push to bring greater technology to what we call the edge, which it could be a structure fire, it could be domestic violence, it could be a major terrorist event. And the problem that still occurred after 9/11 is even though interoperability of radios, there were some improvements in those areas, and as you say, they brought computers to the vehicles. There's still really nothing on the edge for first responders other than their radio to provide critical data and information that they need to perform their job. So that's really that gap that we fill. If you will, radios today is still the technology of choice. Many people are shocked because they watch a lot of TV programs like CSI or NCIS and believe that first responders today is a really fun, technology-rich environment. The reality, it's not. It's like your parents' Hill Street Blues, still using radios. As I like to say, the big innovation in that area is moving from a chalkboard to a whiteboard to manage operations. So it's an exciting time in this area, and that's where we have kind of our niche.
Okay. So before we go more into the technology of what it does and how it serves, let's talk about you as an entrepreneur. Talk to us about, you know, how did you begin this company?
So I've been really fortunate in my career. My whole existence, if you will, over 25 years has been with innovative companies and places where they make new products and, you know, try to figure out new places to deploy technology. So for example, my first two jobs were with Bell Labs and Lockheed Martin Laboratories, still some of the smartest people I've ever met and known, so I kind of got my chops there. My degree is in applied physics, and I have a master's in electrical engineering, so clearly it was in those kind of innovative kind of things, right? But beyond that, you know, since 9/11, I've always been working with either federal government first responder types or local first responder types. I'm very familiar with their needs and areas that they have gaps, if you will.
Okay. So when you graduated school, you got a job with Lockheed and with Bell, and you were working with these groups in the technologies. Talk to us about the leap into your own business, because those are, you know, really big companies, and you know that it's very secure in terms of job and pension and all these things. Why did you become an entrepreneur?
It's a great question. So ironically, it really was that big company experience that kind of turned me off and caused me to go more small company, entrepreneur, innovative in that way. As much as Bell Labs and Lockheed Martin Laboratories at the time were really innovative areas with really smart people and coming out with brilliant technologies, the big company experience of both of those was not really conducive to deploying those quickly to places in the field where they actually could be used. So I guess another thing for me is when I was at Lucent is when the dot-com bust happened. So it was a perfect time to say, okay, let's try another route here and see what happens. So I've been pretty much outside of acquisitions in a small company mode ever since about the year 2000 for that reason. I just felt small companies can better serve those kind of markets and users and get things out there faster in essence.
Okay, so you started to see this this gap in the marketplace through a major catastrophe, 9/11. You saw some gaps in the way technology wasn't really solving a need. So talk to us about how you started to look at this problem and maybe how technology could fix these things.
Right. So after 9/11, I was primarily working with federal kind of user types, let's call it DHS or FBI or any of those kind of guys, even defense users. And they had the products and the technology to basically do the things that we fill a gap today. Granted, it may have been more over laptops or custom personal computers that were designed for their purpose. You may have always seen some of the shows on TV with the warfighter where they flip down their tough book. So they had a way to make these things work, but it was far too expensive to deploy to first responders. And bluntly, there was a lot of training and other things that those types of users have at their disposal that first responders don't. So that was a big deal. So for me, one of the big events, we'll say, that happened that caused me to think we could get some of this technology into first responders' hands was the smartphone itself. It was a low-cost, deployable device that we're all familiar with, and therefore that makes it an ideal candidate for public safety to get that data to the edge that I've suggested.
Okay, right on. So the smartphone came out, and you said, finally, there's a way where we could deploy this technology into the hands, make it more affordable, and to help more. How are you guys, how did you guys break into this, right? And then also talk to us about how you got funded, because we're always interested in hearing, you know, venture-backed companies, what was the story there? How did you get funded? How are you, how does that look for an entrepreneur out there?
Funding is one of the most difficult things for an entrepreneur, particularly ones who are just starting out. More or less, networking is my advice to any of these individuals. If you don't have a network, it's going to be hard. In fact, you're going to need to partner with somebody that has a network if you don't have one. I would say there's also a lot of myths about entrepreneurism that perhaps Silicon Valley or various shows have provided. But one of them is you don't get to walk into a door and talk to a venture capitalist, even if you have a bright idea. You need some sort of relationship with one, or you need somebody else who can refer you to that individual or something like that. Granted, there are places like in Silicon Valley that allow those places where they'll take in fresh ideas out of school. I think it's Y Combinator, right, is a famous one. But in general, networking and relationships. So in my case, I had a relationship with my venture capitalist already. I had worked with him on some other problems that he was interested in prior to this. So when I got done with my last company that got acquired, I pitched him basically on this proposal. He said it was a good pitch. I turned into an EIR, an entrepreneur in residence, for a year. The idea matured from there, and here we are today.
Okay. Talk to us about like having a company acquired. What does that process look like? So you built a company or were a part of a company, and then it got acquired. What does that look like?
Right. So this is the first company I've been CEO at. The last one, I was a vice president, and we were acquired by a large company. It's both an exhilarating time, and it's both an eye-opener. because usually you're acquired by a bigger company. There may be cultural mismatch. There may be even mismatches in things like benefits and how you go about your work day. So, you know, it is absolutely a transition. I've only been through a couple of them, so I don't want to say I have years of experience at that, but it's always a period of, it's like getting to know somebody new all over again, right? And on top of that, you have a whole new set of management that has different objectives and whatnot. So I hope that's kind of what you were asking.
Yeah.
But it's, in a way, that's part of why you build companies. One day they may be acquired. I would say IPOs are more rare today than they ever were. So that usually is your exit route. But it is, it can be very challenging for sure.
Sure. So you were a part of a few acquisition pieces.
A couple, yeah.
And then one day you decided to start a company as CEO. Talk to us about beginning as a CEO. So this is the first time you were a CEO. You pitched to one of your relationships, which you mentioned, partner with someone who has a network, or you got to focus on networking. And that's ultimately how you got funded, is you had a relationship. So what did that look like, you becoming that CEO for the very first time?
Well, that's also interesting, right? Because on one hand, the same way in acquisition, it's both exhilarating and, it's kind of your oh my God moment at the same time, right? Because one of the interesting things about being a CEO of a small company that can be a challenge for people coming out of large companies in particular is you have to do it all. I am still today HR, benefits administrator, help with facility management, you got it, right? So you have to pick up all the pieces because you don't have the staff and you can't ever expect the staff you need to fill every single gap like a big company, right? On the other hand, the beauty of it is you have a vision for a particular product, you are able to execute on that vision and get it going off the ground, right? But the other thing is I like to show a chart of expectations. There is not a single business out there that this is a smooth ride. Every business has its challenges, its pitfalls, its curveballs, be it from, this one was a very unfortunate one. We had a key developer who actually died on us 2 years ago as an example, right? A terrible event. But those are things you have to navigate, as well as market conditions, right? Market conditions can be the toughest. You may not have expected that a recession was going to happen. You may not have expected that the users weren't really ready for your product, right? So that would be my advice to people getting into it, is be ready for a rough ride. It's not all daisies and butterflies, right?
Yeah, it's really not built for everyone, entrepreneurship. But for those who do want to ride that ride, this is really good advice. How big would you say is your company here?
So our company is about 25 people now. We've been in business about 6 years. So we're a decent size at this point, right? We're a mature company. Obviously, we can be more mature and build from there. But we're not the five guys in the basement, which is often how you get started.
Yeah. And then you were talking prior to us recording, you were mentioning being interviewed by someone and they were shocked that this kind of business was here in Orlando. Can you share that story here?
Yeah, this happens, I'm gonna say, somewhat frequently, depending on who you're talking to, because Orlando, while there is some entrepreneur capabilities and the government's definitely put some programs in place, I think you'll find that there's not too many mature, I hesitate to call us a startup at this point, I like to say we're a small company, but mature companies that could be acquired by something interesting later on. So the last time this occurred, that individual really was of the belief that Orlando was for employees for Disney World and agriculture and your typical kind of needs, and was kind of surprised that there was a startup with a market leading position of a product in a segment that our community was supporting indirectly.
So you being a venture-backed company, not from the VC is not here in Orlando, it's outside of Orlando. Why did you choose to stay in Orlando and continue to build a company here?
Right. Well, we're very unusual in that regard, as you likely know. Normally, if your funding comes from Silicon Valley or it comes from Boston or it comes from Austin, the venture capitalist usually wants you close to that because there's a belief that there's a community of assets available to you in that, that they've built this ecosystem, right? So in our case, there was a couple reasons that our venture capitalist and myself agreed on this. We actually did talk about moving this company to, well, moving is not appropriate. It would have been Britt Kane Moving and another gentleman who helped us start the company. But, you know, the dynamics of starting a company in Silicon Valley for software are equally as challenging. So at that time, talent, and today it's still very difficult, but acquisition of talent is one of the most important things of any company. And we agreed that that was going to be difficult in Silicon Valley, primarily based on his experience with some of his other companies. So I would say that was the key element. But the other key element is we can run this company for a lot less money than we can in Silicon Valley, Boston, and Austin. And then third, there is the availability of talent here that, you know, and being startups are not that normal here, you know, we're not fighting with other startups for those particular talent pools.
I've heard that often as Orlando is a great place for talent. Where do you find a lot of your talent comes from here and around Central Florida?
You know, we've really gotten it all over the place. I mean, it's come from both some of the defense contractors in the area and us being a government entity in a way of sourcing technology to government. Obviously, we're going to pull people from there. We've gotten it from commercial elements. We've gotten some from UCF. So there's not been any one particular, I'm going to say, source. You know, it's not like we're out picketing in front of Lockheed Martin, shall I say, right? We put ads in our local kind of channels that you would find software engineers or business people. And what I will say is we've been very fortunate again in finding very good people. And we usually get a lot of resumes when we have a job opening come in, so we can also afford to be very selective at the same time.
Yeah. Any advice out there for other entrepreneurs or CEOs who are kind of in this growth stage that you guys are in, you know, 20 employees, or they're looking to grow to that point, about hiring specifically?
Well, getting back to the original comment, right? Hiring is one of the most important things you can do in any company. And bluntly, that's big or small, right? I would say it's more important to small because if you make mistakes in a big company, you have more assets at your disposal to manage that situation. Or let's just say a number, 1 out of 50 is not as important as 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 10, for example, right? But I would say you need to be very diligent in your interview process. That's where I've seen the most mistakes made. A typical interview where you have where you're going to talk to somebody for an hour, I don't believe you can really understand who that individual is and whether he fits in your culture. And speaking of culture, that's another very important element. You need individuals who really believe in your culture and want to embrace that. To your point about, you know, entrepreneurism isn't for everybody. Small companies or startups are not for everybody either. You know, if you're used to kind of the 8-to-5 job and a regular existence, shall I say, you know, this may or may not be for you.
What would you say is your culture that you have here and that you've built?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very proud of our culture here. Because that, again, that's one of the important things of any small company. And it's usually defined by a few people. That's like it or not, that's the way it works, right? You know, even at Apple, right, it was defined by Steve Jobs. But he was such a strong individual. He could execute that over a very large company. But we really try for a few things here. So one is we do allow our employees to work at home as need be. So that remote nature, believe it or not, that's a significant advantage. But we need employees who can be accountable to themselves as a result of that. When you have a remote policy in your company, having employees that aren't accountable to themselves or want to drive to build those products, you know, you're not managing these people. We don't believe in managing somebody or micromanaging them as a result of that. Otherwise, we couldn't make that offer. Funny enough, a lot of companies are pulling back on that now, right? Melissa, Yahoo actually pulled back on all the Yahoo employees. Google does not really allow too many offsite employees, right? But as a small company, we believe we can do that, and we believe that's an incentive to our employees. The other piece of culture is just being, I hate to say it, but we try not to find the prima donna, right? We have a small company. You have to be able to fit into our team. We don't really want the individual. They may be brilliant, but if they can't work in a team and they can't work independently and they can't collaborate, that's a big issue for us. Some companies can allow those types of individuals because they can provide value and isolate them. We can't allow that. And then lastly, I would just say, you have to have that small company mentality, obviously, right? We don't have the resources to, for example, we don't have somebody who can just specialize on website design, right? Our engineers have to pitch in on that as one example, maybe on the engineering side. So you have to be a person of many disciplines. That's what I'm getting at. We try not to find people who can just do one thing and one thing well, because ultimately in a small company, you have to kind of cross a lot of disciplines.
Yeah. That's incredible. Have you had any, in your growing process, 6 years, 25 employees, what was one of the biggest challenges you faced as a CEO and that you've overcome?
Right. Well, there's many challenges. Yeah. Like I pointed out earlier, right? Yeah. It's again, just to say it one more time, right? While it's amazing to be a CEO, it's also a very challenging job, and you can count on things happening, right? I saw an interview with Mark Cuban on Shark Tank. Well, it wasn't really an interview. It was Shark Tank. And one of the potential candidates he asked him, well, how smooth is it? Because he had been around for 4 or 5 years. He's like, oh, it's gone perfect. He's like, okay, I'm not investing in you. And the individual said, well, why? He goes, I know you're not telling the truth. Every company has challenges. So the most challenging one, I would say ultimately it has been our end customer that we didn't realize it was going to take longer for them to adopt our technology. That's probably been the biggest challenge that we've had to overcome. So we've had to diversify our business a little bit and other things that are kind of adjacent to manage that situation. I mean, I am happy to say that last year and this year we're seeing a much bigger bounce because things are happening. But we launched in the Great Recession, so that's nearly a 3-year timeout, which that can be a challenge in itself. Thankfully, I'll say we didn't launch earlier than that. But managing, in a more broad sense, just managing an unknown market condition, even though you believe you have the right product, has been a big challenge.
Okay. Now let's talk about your technology. Give us some examples about how your technology has solved a major issue in the field. So maybe some real life examples, if you're able to talk about it.
Yeah, cool. Those are, of course, the most exciting things, right? It's the things you can relate to. So on the most human level, one of my favorite examples is going back to what our technology does. It allows you to communicate, collaborate, and coordinate much more quickly than you can with voice alone or without voice. So it's a very visual representation of positions on a map, of information sharing such as pictures, documents, that sort of thing, emergency notification, and we do integrate voice over cellular on top of all this. So if you take that as kind of your broad stroke, one of my favorite examples is actually state fairs, or one in particular, Balloon Fiesta in Albuquerque. Most of us as parents have children, and the worst thing that can happen is a lost child, independent of other types of public safety situations, because that one personally affects us, right? So normally, when there's a lost child at a state fair or this Balloon Fiesta, a 911 call is placed to your PSAP, and sorry to use that lingo, but PSAP is basically the point at which operators take in or dispatchers take in 911 calls and distribute them. So you get a 911 call. It goes out over the radio to whoever is managing that event, which could be firefighters, law enforcement or EMS, hey, we've got a missing child. They will go find the parent. They'll try to give a description of the child, and the officers, we'll just use the law enforcement one as an example, will then distribute that information on the radio. So it's a verbal description of a missing child. You have no idea where other law enforcement individuals are in the field through verbal commands. And as you can imagine, a state fair, you don't have roads and other landmarks that you would typically have in a city. So you can't say, I'm on 5th on North as an example, right? It's, well, I'm next to the circus, or I'm next to the Big Top, and it's unfamiliar territory. So anyway, what our technology in this case is, normally a missing child could be anywhere from 1 hour to 2 hours at times, unfortunately. Rarely do they go missing forever, thank God. Normally, you know, it's a criminal situation. We're not really talking about criminal situations. But what our technology allows, let's use officers as an example, to take a picture of that child, because we all have pictures of our kids on smartphones. They'll take a picture of that child right on a smartphone. They'll distribute it to the entire law enforcement staff that's on site, and also civilian staff if they happen to be available. They'll know where the law enforcement personnel is located, so the closest ones to that missing child can find them. And it's a much more effective medium to locate missing children. So we were able to reduce these occurrences from, say, something like 1 hour to 2 hours down to a few minutes. They're very quickly found. So it's a really, you know, cool application for these types of situations. But certainly, you know, there are other uses for our technology. I guess I'll give another one with specifically EMS and fire. We were at a marathon in Texas, and again, today's world with public events, they're well staffed with security and fire and EMS. In this case, there was a elderly woman who had fainted because it was a very hot day. It wasn't even a participant. They were able to dispatch a medic because they were able to pinpoint that location on a map. They knew the closest medic visually on that map. They were able to share a picture of that individual, and they were able to get that woman to a hospital immediately. We were told she could have died if the response had gone longer than 15 or 20 minutes. So it's those types of scenarios.
Yeah. And when I was in EMS, and we would have a radio, so if someone had a missing child, we would have to, it was like the game of operator. We have, you know, a missing child, and we would, you know, dispatch that. And then by the time it got to the, you know, people in the field looking for maybe the missing child or a patient, the description could have been totally busted. And it's sometimes it's hard to hear at a carnival or at one of these kind of events. So, you know, being able to see the picture or being able to pinpoint a very specific location, I think that's extremely valuable. So you guys specifically work with, you know, government agencies, municipalities, with their first responders, fire, police, EMS, right, to deploy this technology. Is it difficult to, I guess this is a question that I already know the answer. Is it difficult to work with these groups to adopt this new technology because they're used to the radio or they're used to tough books? Or what is your experience there?
Yeah, it can be, absolutely, right? Because first responders are a creature of habit. And sometimes, I shouldn't even say sometimes. A lot of times it's a good reason they're a creature of habit. They know that's what works. That's what's defined in their standard operating procedures. And when you bring a new technology to the fight, per se, there's a lot of unknown variables. You know, they're risk managers, really, at the end of the day. So the analysis is not the same as a business of, well, can this bring me more profit or can this help me with my competitors? It's more about, certainly, can this provide greater safety to myself and my community? But B, what are the downsides of using this technology? And that's what they tend to evaluate. So culture is a big play. I will actually segue that what's interesting with this is we've now gotten a lot of bites from enterprise customers who are interested in our solution at the same time because of those assets I've described, right? It's kind of to use another term, it's situational awareness, which is a term well known to first responders. But now we're finding, that's why I kind of said business critical, we're finding enterprise customers have the same issues, maybe in a different form, and they're also seeing those same benefits. But my point being, they have the same challenges with adopting a technology, right? When you have a mission critical technology, it has to work, right? And so that's very important to our first responders. It's very important to these business critical applications at the same time.
I totally understand. So we see where you guys are at now. You're here in Orlando, Florida, 25 employees, 6 years old company. What do you think the future of your company looks like? What would you like to see as your all's future?
Yeah, well, it is really exciting for us right now. Like I say, we've seen some real movement in the last couple of years. And I think you will find that we'll be one of the major players in this space for the adoption of those edge level technologies, because our capability is so fundamental to those organizations, right? So I believe you're going to see 3 or 4 years from now, maybe you won't know the word Intrepid, but now when you watch CSI or you watch it, it will be reality for what they have in the field for some of these capabilities.
Yeah. And everyone right now is carrying a smartphone, police, fire. You know, almost everybody has a smartphone. So this seems like a logical application that people could put on their device to make themselves better at their job, but also safer. So as we're kind of wrapping up this conversation, I always like to ask a few questions about, you know, the person. As you were building and growing your business, is there anybody that you would like to kind of give a shout out to or thank them for helping you along in business, or maybe a mentor? Do you have anybody that comes to mind? And I'm kind of putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, well, certainly there are three people who helped kind of get the company off the ground. So obviously I thank the venture capitalists for believing in the vision, right? We have an advisor, Dan Steer, who's been a very valuable asset to our company. I've been at this 20 years, but again, this is my first gig as CEO, and he's been very helpful to guide some of those practices in a small company. And then we had another individual, Joel Villa, who is now off in Europe doing some interesting things, who also helped start this company with some of the ideas and you know, founding kind of evolution of technology into these assets. So certainly those people are very helpful. Prior to that, it's hard to identify one person, because I really took a lot of insights from a lot of different people that I met over the years and kind of incorporated it into what we are today. By the way, sometimes I kind of turn the question the other way. Sometimes these things aren't mentors. There's sometimes you're watching people make mistakes and going, oh yeah, okay, let me deposit that one because I don't want to make that mistake. So I do want to point out, some of your experiences aren't all about a mentor, you know, telling you what to do. It's observing what not to do as well.
Yeah, I guess that's wisdom, is learning from other people's mistakes and watching out. So this has been an exciting conversation, especially because of the background that I have and what I see in store for your company and Orlando. I really appreciate you sharing your journey, sharing the advice to the entrepreneurs out there. If people want to learn more about Intrepid Networks, where could they go to find out more about the company, and where could they go to find out more about you?
Right. So Intrepid Networks, the web obviously is the first resource. You can find our contact information if you want more. It's www.intrepid-networks.com. And certainly to find out more about me, you can find my profile on LinkedIn if you want. You can give me an invite request. I get, I hate to say it, many a week at this point, right? And then, you know, from there, if there's an interest in a conversation, I can certainly strike one up.
Okay. And I'll put these links in the show notes to this podcast. So if you're listening, driving or walking or jogging, just know that you could go back to the show notes and you could click on the links, and it'll immediately go to the website or to Britt's LinkedIn to make it easy for you guys. So being the host of Orlando Entrepreneurs, I just want to thank the audience for listening in to the stories of Orlando entrepreneurs and pitching in to help and to lift up this community of entrepreneurs and small business owners so that we can build a better future for Orlando, for our kids, for our family, for future people here in Orlando. So I just want to thank you guys for listening into this interview. Hope you found it helpful, enjoyable, and feel free to reach out to myself or to Britt and just say, hey, we heard you on the show and we'd like to, you know, connect with you, learn more, maybe get on the show, or maybe come work with Britt at Intrepid. So until then, we'll see you guys on the next episode. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You can also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.